Thank you. Thank you very much for the introduction. And thanks to the organizer for inviting me, but especially for putting together such a nice conference. So far, the talks have been universally great, and well, here's mine. I want to talk about symmetries from string theory. So many of the things that we have seen, to some extent, seem to arise quite naturally in string theory. And I want to summarize how that works, so to the extent that we understand it. So it will be based on a few papers I wrote, starting with this paper with Ben and Diego. It will focus quite a bit in this paper I wrote last December with Fabio, Federico, my student Shagar, and Sakura. And I will also say something in this time about the paper with Michele and Sakura from March. The talk is necessarily a little bit technical at parts, because we want to understand geometries of some complicated spaces. So my introduction aims to give sort of the big picture of what we are aiming to do in this program. It's not quite what we have achieved, but it's what we want to achieve if we can do it. So for me, string theory, in the context of this talk, is just a tool that, given some singular manifold X, produces some quantum field theory that we call T of X. It's a machine that you give me geometry with some nice properties, and it gives me a field theory, in principle. So this point of view goes under the name of geometric engineering. So you learn the rules for constructing manifolds X in such a way that your theory T of X has properties that you like and that you understand. If you have a theory, as we have seen, well, it has symmetries, and to these symmetries you can associate topological field theory, which we call the symmetry TFT. I'll review this a little bit later, but it appeared already in Justin's talk. This is a TFT in one dimension higher, which encodes the symmetries and the anomalies of the theory. This is the object that will appear most naturally in the string construction. In fact, as I will try to explain, T of X is very often quite mysterious. We cannot say a lot about T of X itself. But the thing that we are starting to learn the rules about, and the thing that seems to be easier to describe, in part because it's much simpler, is the symmetry theory for T of X. So that's the thing I'll explain how to construct. So we have seen a few talks already that start by giving some Lagrangian for some theory. So in the cases in which T of X has a Lagrangian, you can apply those ideas. And then it's in principle possible, but of course it involves a lot of thinking and clever ideas, to find all the symmetries of the theory. But if you are able to do this, eventually you'll be able to construct the symmetry theory of X. Unfortunately, when we are doing this in the context of string theory, we don't have the luxury of having a Lagrangian. So very often we know that some theory exists, and we know that some theory is interesting for different reasons, but we don't have a Lagrangian that flows to the theory. And then we just cannot apply any of these rules. In fact, it's hard to count. We have infinite examples, but it's sort of sporadic that you have a Lagrangian for a given geometry. The rule is that you don't. You get some interesting strongly coupled theories, but you cannot describe them, start them from some gauge theory with some matter fields. What we do know is the topology and some test metric of the manifold X that we started with. And this is precisely in the cases where we don't know Lagrangian that we care most about the symmetries of the theory. The symmetries of the theory are sort of the most important part of the theory, at least the starting point. So this makes the analysis very valuable. This is the thing that motivates us to look at the symmetry theory for all these theories. If we learn enough about this, we may be able to say interesting things about the theory here. As an example that we will not discuss in any detail, but in some cases there are conjecture Lagrangians for some of these theories. So some of these theories may be n equal to 2 supersymmetric in 4 dimensions, meaning the 8 supercharges in 4 dimensions. And people have conjecture, for example, Lagrangians with less supersymmetry, n equal to 1 Lagrangians, that are expected to flow in the IR to these theories. These are conjectures, but well-motivated conjectures, but one thing you can do is, if you know how to compute abstractly the symmetry TFT of your theory, as we know, and you know by using standard techniques how to compute the symmetry theory of your of your Lagrangian description, then you can compare these two things and they should agree because the symmetry theory is an RG flow invariant. Okay, so this is, if you like, one application in the context of testing dualities. So there was a more technical thing. You might not care about these strongly coupled CFTs in higher dimensions. To me, there's a second reason I find quite exciting, is that one of the motivations between thinking about generalized symmetries is that you may want to try to fix Landau's paradigm. We know it doesn't quite work because of the higher symmetries, if you just think about zero-form symmetries. But if you think about the general enough notion of symmetries, it might work. So in the context of these geometrically engineered theories, there seems to be a geometric version of this problem, which seems tractable. So as I will explain, this map that given a geometry gives you the symmetry theory is very, very sensitive to very fine details of X. Things like torsional cycles, which are things that are not so to deal with the standard string theory techniques. In some cases, it might depend on the specific flavor of generalized cohomology that you put on X. So, because this map is so sensitive, you might hope or dream that it is in some sense invertible. So given the symmetries of the theory, then you might be able to reconstruct the geometry. To me, this is a formulation which is geometric for the Landau question. The Landau question is simply whether the Landau paradigm works. So if you know the symmetries of the theory, can you reconstruct the space that you started with that defines the theory in the geometric engineering point of view? Now, this cannot quite work because X typically is defined only up to dualities, string dualities. So there are many string constructions that give you one field theory. But we have a little, we have lists of string dualities that we know. So probably some question like this, can we reconstruct X modulo string dualities given the symmetry theory? Might be a good question to try to solve.
Can I just ask about the motivation? Mm-hmm. So am I thinking about the symmetry theories as like universality classes in this paradigm?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for the question, and please ask questions during the talk if you have questions. So this is perhaps, you may think a little bit strong. You might not want just the, you might not want to reconstruct the whole X. Maybe there's a subset of data of X that's enough to determine T of X completely. When I try to weaken the conditions, I don't get very far. So to me, it seems like this statement, the strong one may be just as likely to be true as the weak one. And I'm conjecturing things anyway, so let me just conjecture this. If you want to make this even more precise, so there's a very interesting paper by Caorsi and Cecotti that we developed a little bit further with Michele and Sagar, in which they think out some category that you can associate to X. You can think of the derived category of coherent shifts or things like that. And from this category, you can read all the BPS information of the theory, which in these papers we argued encodes at least some non-trivial bits of the symmetry theory. So you can also go back, and by knowing some bits of the symmetry theory, you can reconstruct some structure of this category. In this particular case, we argued based on Caorsi and Cecotti that the Grothendieck group of this cluster category in this particular formulation can be read from the symmetry theory. So we have given some small steps in this direction. I will not summarize this here, but there's some indications that some of this can be done. The big question is whether you can really invert this map. I think this is a very interesting formal question. And it puts this conjecture in a bit, it puts the Landau question in a bit more formal footing. All right, so that's kind of the big picture kind of thing, the reason why I'm interested in these problems. In practice, we don't do this in complete generality, so you want to impose restrictions on the manifold that we consider. So first of all, I will consider X to be non-compact to the coupled gravity. And just because it makes the details easier, I will assume that X is a real cone over some base B. There's a physics reason for this, and it's that if you have something which is a cone, it's invariant under scalings of the cone, scalings of the cone, and that's closely connected to the resulting theory being a conformal field theory. Conformal field theories are important for physicists. And we want to keep some control over the field theory, and for that we make the theory supersymmetric. And geometrically that is translated into the fact that the manifold X, in which I'm putting my theory, has reduced holonomy. That means that you parallel transport the spinner around, there's a spinner that stays invariant and appears as a preserved supersymmetry in lower dimensions. So the standard incarnation of this reduced holonomy condition is that we might want to study Calabi-Yau manifolds. So here's an example, one of the simplest non-trivial examples is you take X to be a complex twofold, so a four real dimensional space. And if you impose these two conditions, you end up with the spaces which are of the form ALE, so C2 mod a subgroup of SD2, discrete subgroup of SD2. These are classified by an AD classification. So this is a cone over S3 mod gamma, and here gamma acts freely on the S3. It has a singularity at the origin, so this subgroup acts freely everywhere except at the origin, and you have an orbifold singularity there where interesting things happen. So I'll try to review later why interesting things happen, but I will come in a few slides. So here's an example of something very interesting that happens when you put a string theory in such singular manifolds. You put TEP to be a string theory, a particular flavor of a string theory that is formulated in 10 dimensions, and you put it on this geometry here, you obtain a very strange object, the 2,0 superconformality theory of type G. We know fairly little about this theory. It was discovered 25 years ago or something like that, and 27 now, long time ago. And this is still very mysterious. It's an important theory because one of the things you can do, for example, is to put it on a torus, and it gives you n equal to 4 super Young Mills, and you can identify the diffeomorphisms of the torus with the SL2C transformations of n equal to 4. So things that are quite subtle in theory, these SL2C strong weak dualities, get translated into geometric statements of the compactification of this theory. And based on this, well, there has been many developments. Classes theories are important, and you can do 3D theories and so on. So by thinking of compactifications of this theory, you can get quite far in understanding quantum field theory. So these two massive theories are believed to be indexed by this gamma, or equivalently by an AD gauge algebra. So as I mentioned, this is a very important theory, and it's also very strange. It is an interacting conformality theory in 6 dimensions. And from a Lagrangian point of view, the existence of these theories is a surprise. Well, it's not a surprise because it was 27 years ago. At the time, I guess it was a surprise, I don't know. By dimensional reasons, any d-dimensional gauge theory becomes free as you go to large distances, and I should have said when d is bigger than 4. So in 6 dimensions in particular, if you write a gauge theory Lagrangian, it will always flow to a free theory in the IR. But this is an interacting free theory in 6 dimensions. So as I mentioned, one interesting property of the 2,0, in a sense, is the thing that makes it, one of the things that makes it very interesting, is that if you take the 2,0 theory with algebra G and you put it on a torus, you get a 4D n equal to 4 with complex structure tau with algebra G and complexified gauge coupling tau. So the complexified gauge coupling is the same as the complex structure of the torus. I'm going to call this thing I just described here with lots of words, I'm going to call it G4. Not quite a field theory yet, but it is the description of what local operators do. So this thing I just said, it does not fully fix the partition function on K3. That's one of the things that just by giving me an algebra, by telling me I have an equal to 4 theory with gauge algebra SD2, say, I haven't fully fixed the partition function K3. That's one of the things I don't know. But it still makes sense as an object to consider, and one way of making sense of it is as a relative theory, as described by Darren Constantine in this paper. So you can think of it as the set of boundary modes for a topological theory in 1 dimension higher. So here's the 5-dimensional topological theory. So this theory includes information about the potential symmetries of the theory once you actually define a theory, the anomalies and the gaugings. So just to give it a name, I'm going to call it the symmetry TFT. The picture is this, nothing familiar picture. You have the local modes here on the boundary, and then they're attached to some TFT on the back. Yeah? In this way, you can give meaning to this word I was saying before of an equal to 4 theory with gauge algebra SU2. But in physics, we're more used to treating proper theories, things that give us partition functions and manifolds, and you can do that. The thing you do is you take your symmetry theory and you introduce an interface, a gapped interface, between the symmetry theory here and some anomaly theory. So I'm going to call this interface rho. The choice of interface is essentially the choice of, in physics language, the global form of the theory that you're defining, n equal to 4 in this case. And to obtain the standard picture of a field theory coupled to an anomaly theory, you just collide this rho with G. So you reduce the symmetry theory to nothing. You collapse these two things, and then you get an ordinary theory in physics language coupled to an invertible theory of the anomaly theory. So in a different language, Aharon and Shaver and Tachikawa classified essentially the choices of rho. So which completions you can make once you specify the local degrees of freedom. And the reformulation in this language was done essentially in a paper by Witten before this, for his UN case, and then we extended it to the D and E cases. Yes? Oh, yeah, thank you.
Can you repeat the question?
Yes. I'm going to repeat what I think the question is. How do I make sure that this is capturing all the anomalies and symmetries of the theory? Yeah. Actually, I think it doesn't. So I'm here talking about things like one-form symmetries and some of the zero-form symmetries. Things like the Bile anomaly in supersymmetry theories, I don't know how to fit in this language. So it's not a full description. Description of all the symmetries of things like n equal to 4 and supersymmetric theories. In those cases, I don't know of a counterexample. But in non-supersymmetric theories, there are things I don't know how to do in this language. Happy to talk about that later. But for me, the biggest thing out of this framework is the Bile anomaly. In supersymmetric theories, you can relate the Bile anomaly to an ordinary anomaly of the R symmetry. So you can formulate it in this way, but in general, you cannot. And when you cannot, I don't know what to do. I welcome comments about this. I don't know what to do with those ones. Thank you. That's a good question. Right. So the motivation of this talk and our starting point was that was a theory that was not living in four dimensions directly, but was rather the 10-dimensional string theory. On a manifold that was some four manifold where you want to define your four dimensional theory, the ALE orbifold, the complex dimension two space where you're putting type to be a string theory to get the 2,0 and the torus in which you're compactifying the 2,0 to get n equal to 4. So, one question I'm going to answer now is how do you reproduce the previous discussion from the string theory perspective? Which is how do you obtain this 5-dimensional theory? Then being calling symmetry of G4. My goal would be to derive symmetry of G4 without using any knowledge about the Lagrangian of n equal to 4. In this case, of course, I could use the Lagrangian because I have one, but I want to develop techniques that apply to all the cases, including those that don't have Lagrangian. And I should say I don't have a general prescription. I cannot give you a TFT, a fully extended TFT, definitely not. I'm going to work out some aspects of the symmetry theories. In particular, in some cases, I can write a Lagrangian for the SIM-TFT. Even if I don't know the Lagrangian for the theory itself, I know the Lagrangian for the symmetry theory in one dimension high. Yeah. Any questions so far? This was kind of the big picture. Now I'm going to go into the nitty-gritty details. Okay, so let me say something more about geometric engineering to give a little bit of intuition how these things work. So before you start doing geometric engineering, you have to fix a formulation of a string theory. They're connected by duality, so typically if you know how to do it in one frame, you have a decent idea how to start doing it in a different frame, although often involves a bit of work, changing frame. In this talk, I will mostly work in M theory, which is an 11-dimensional flavor of a string theory, a manifestation in 11 dimensions, and also type 2b, which is a 10-dimensional manifestation. In either frame, the words I can use are the same, so I'm going to treat them in parallel. For me, big D, when it's 11, it will mean that I'm in M theory. When big D is 10, it means that I'm in type 2B. Okay, so we want to place the theory on some manifold X. This is the singular manifold. It's a complex manifold in this talk. So it has real dimension 2n, n is the complex dimension. And then the rest of the space is where the field theory will live. So this is a manifold of dimension big D minus 2n. Because I want to preserve supersymmetry, I'm going to make X Clavijau. And because I want to talk out CFTs, it's going to be a cone with space here. For the moment, I will complicate things later, but for the moment, I will assume that the singularity is only at the base of the cone. At this point on the cone, at the base of the cone, you have a field theory, which I'm calling T of X. This field theory lives in this manifold. This is a geometric picture. In geometric engineering, we treat the background geometry, X times M, as given. So in string theory, it's a theory of quantum gravity. You have to think of the fluctuations of the geometry. But in this case, we ignore the dynamics. And we can do that basically because we are talking about the CFT living on M, and X is non-compact. And then you can do a little calculation and convince yourself that the gravitational modes are irrelevant from the point of view of the CFT. As I will say, this decoupling is not entirely true. There's a subtlety that's very important for my discussion, but at least at the level of Lagrangians, that's true. So all the dynamics, if it doesn't come from geometry, it has to come from somewhere. And in this case, it comes from p-brains and also fluxes. So what's this? P-brains are dynamical supersymmetric solitons, meaning you should think of like a sheet of dimension, space-time dimension p plus 1. Something that you put in a space-time, space-time dimension p plus 1. And it wiggles, moves in space, and you can excite it in different ways. So there's symmetric, there's supersymmetric and non-supersymmetric brains. For understanding these supersymmetric theories, the important brains are the supersymmetric ones. And this can be classified. These are the defects that you can put in your theory. Well, defect, no, these solitons that you can put in your theory that preserve some supersymmetry. So you can classify them. In M theory, there are only two. You have something called the M2 and the M5. And for those who are not familiar with this, in string theory, we use this funny convention that if we write a 2 here, it really means that the object is three-dimensional. You write a 5, it means it's six-dimensional in space-time. Right? So in M theory, it's in a way simpler because you have this, just these two objects. They are harder to understand, but you only have two. In type 2B, you have many more objects. So you have first the dp brains, which are p plus one dimensional. You have dp brains with p equal to minus 1, 1, 3, 5, 7, 9. And then you have f1s and ns5s. So if I want to do a full discussion, I have to think about all of them. But for the purposes of this talk, I will just focus on d3 brains, which can be the most interesting part of the story. So these are four-dimensional objects. So brains are coupled electrically, so to background fields. In particular, a p-brain, which is a p plus one dimensional object, is coupled electrically to some background p plus one form gauge field, which I'm going to call C. And if you have an electrically charged particle, the way you can measure it without looking at this coupling in the Lagrangian is by constructing some manifold that links it. And in this manifold that links the brain, you integrate Hodge star of F, where F is simply D of C. If you get something different from zero, this quantizes. If you get one, for example, it means you have one brain inside. Now, these fluxes satisfy a duality condition. So you have, I wrote brains from minus 1 to 9, and there's analogous fluxes, so fields C0, C2, and so on. If I include all the fluxes, then it's called the democratic formulation. I have a bunch of Fs, but they're not all independent. So Fp plus 2 is equal to the Hodge star of Fd minus p plus 2. Right? So this is an equation you have to impose in the Fs. Meaning, because F is D of C, this means that not all the Cs are independent. You should think of this equation as telling you that you think of this as the electric background, this is the magnetic background. Right? So you can interpret then this equation. Instead of saying that the p-brain is charged electrically under this flux, you can say it's also charged magnetically under this flux. So the Hodge star is missing. Okay. Much of this talk will be about measuring charges. So this is the kind of charges I'll be measuring, essentially. I'm going to measure electric and magnetic charges of brains in my geometry. So these charges are the things that live or give the interesting behavior in the topological theory and the symmetry topological theory. So let's try to understand a little bit how the quantum field theory arises. I need to understand this to explain to you how line operators are described in the language without using a Lagrangian. So I'm interested ultimately in singular spaces. But let me consider a family of smooth Calabi-Yau spaces. So every element in the family is smooth and it's indexed by some epsilon. But when I take the limit when epsilon goes to zero, or when I set epsilon to zero, if you like, I get the singular space. So you have a manifold of smooth spaces, which is smooth everywhere except at the origin. The fiber is smooth except at the origin. So in pictures, what's happening, I think I have a picture, is that you have manifolds that look like this. They have some two cycles, for example, in this particular case. This case is C2 mod set N. So the set N acts like this. It's just a phase on the X and Y coordinates of C2. And I can do a blow up, meaning I can replace the singularity by this chain, this collection of two spheres that intersect at points. And this is the family I'm talking about. So I will have manifolds like this with these two spheres. The size of the two sphere is epsilon, roughly. And when I take the limit of these two spheres to be zero size, I get a singular point. This thing here is smooth, but once I take the limit of zero size spheres, it becomes singular. Question? So one of the beautiful facts about this geometric engineering is that it's a beautiful fact in mathematics, but it can be given a string theory interpretation, is that these subgroups that I'm putting here of SU2 have an AD classification, and the way these two spheres intersect is according to a Dynkin diagram of the algebra AD. You know the intersection numbers if you know the subgroup here. Okay, so I'm going to now take my p-brains, which are extended, and I'm going to wrap them in these cycles here. So wrapping a p-brain on a small q-cycle of size epsilon gives me a propagating object in the field theory that I'm constructing. The propagating object will have dimension. Well, it started being p plus 1, that's a p-brain. And because it's wrapping some small cycle, from large distances, it looks like those dimensions have disappeared. So you have a p plus 1 minus q dimensional object moving around. And if you look at, in a bit more detail to the definition of what a p-brain is, you will see that the mass of the p-brain is proportional to the volume of the cycle that you're wrapping. So when this volume goes to zero, this object becomes lighter and lighter until it's massless. So here are two important examples. M theory on this orbifold here times flat space, say. You take the M2s, which are wrapping the S2 cycles. Well, M2s have three dimensions, 2 plus 1 is 3. They're wrapping in S2, so effectively they become a one-dimensional object. That means a particle moving in time. So these are just a light particle propagating in R7. So when these become massless, these light particles, these massless particles, are precisely the vector multiplets in the Jamming theory you have in 7 dimensions. So this will become a Jamming theory with algebra, in this case, SUN. And this object gives you a non-abelian structure. And this is the other example, I have already mentioned it. You to put type 2b on C2 mod set N, and now you wrap d3s, which are the objects that exist in type 2b. Okay, so d3s are four-dimensional. You take two dimensions, you wrap them in this sphere, these two spheres here. So you get a two-dimensional object propagating in space-time, or equivalently, you have in a space a string that's moving in time. So you have a theory of light strings. In some sense, this has to be non-abelian for the same reasons as here, although we don't understand very well what that means. But this is what we have. We have some theory of preserved supersymmetry. You can check that it's the 2,0 supersymmetry, and it's of type A2m-1. sorry, a n minus 1. But in this way, you can construct a theory they don't quite understand. Hard to, we don't have a Lagrangian, so we don't understand it very well. But geometrically, it's a fairly simple geometry. You might aim to understand some things without having to know a Lagrangian. Okay, so these were the dynamical states, the excitations of the field theory. That's how they come from. That's where they come from. Well, at least the most interesting ones come from there. Right, but you also have operators. In particular, if you want to understand things like n equal to 4 in 4 dimensions, you want to understand line operators that are the things that are charged under one-form symmetries. So what are the line operators? You can view these as infinitely heavy objects which are inserted into your configuration. I said that the mass of the brain from the effective field theory point of view is given by the volume of the cycle that it's wrapping. So if you want something infinitely massive, something super heavy, what you want to do is to wrap it on a cycle which is very large in the space, in the internal space. In this case, C2 mod gamma. In particular, the larger cycles are the non-compact ones. So that's the things that have infinite size. So line operators, you think of them geometrically as non-compact cycles in your internal geometry. By the way, I use this, the words internal and external. Internal geometry means the geometry where I'm putting a string theory that has a singularity. The field theory lives in the external geometry, like this perpendicular. Okay, so these are line operators, very simple. These are non-compact brains. These are not topological. Wilson lines are not topological in Jamil's. The things you really want to study in the field theory, in the topography theory, are the things that measure how many Wilson lines you have. And those are flux operators. Those are the flux operators that I mentioned before, the integral of f, the integral of star f, essentially. So what you do is, in the internal space, you integrate on a cycle linking your brain. Right? And the reason this is linking is because I have torsion. So things are good. Right. Okay, these are the objects of interest. These are the lines. But if I'm thinking just purely of the symmetry theory, the thing I care about are the charge operators, and these are the integrals of fluxes over these kind of cycles here. All right? Any questions so far? Yeah.
I have not understood whether you have a geometric characterization also for these for the topological operators. But how do you know that these are topological?
These are the integral of f and star f. Because of the equations of motion, d of f and d of star of f are 0.
No, no, okay, I see. But I mean, from the geometric characterization, are you able to see whether an operator is topological or not?
Let me say it differently. Because it's the integral of f and the integral of star f, I can characterize this as some classes in cohomology, and that's manifestly topological. Thank you. That's a good question. That's all very beautiful, but that's very basic. So the question is, where does the SIM TFT live in this construction? Right? I told you that if you just give me the local operators, the behavior of the local operators, you haven't given me a theory yet, you have to give me some extra information, these boundary conditions or interface. Where does this live in string theory? Well, a general fact about any theory in non-compact space is that if you want to define it fully, you have to give me the behavior at infinity. In this case, I have a non-compact manifold. M, I can choose to be compact, just to make my life simple. So the field theory will live in a compact manifold. But X is non-compact, something like C2 mod gamma. And then I need to specify what happens at infinity, which in this case means the base of the cone times m. So I have to give you what the fluxes do at infinity. That's part of the data of the supergravity. And You do this by giving a state in the Hilbert space that the string theory associates to this manifold here. So this manifold is codimension one in space-time, and it's associated to the Hilbert space. So given boundary conditions, it's given a state in this Hilbert space. Of course, this Hilbert space is quite difficult to understand, but the important thing is the gradient due to flux, and this was understood in a series of papers by Krem-Moore, Dan-Fried, and Krem-Siegel. And the key point here, the thing that makes the whole story interesting, is that the cycle that's being wrapped here is a torsional cycle. So you're measuring flux in torsional cycles. I won't explain why it's torsional, that goes into the details of this computation, but you can easily see it's torsional. It's basically the base of the cone C2 mod gamma is S3 mod gamma, and S3 mod gamma has torsion. It's as simple as that. S3 mod gamma is a torsional cycle, and I have to pick a representative, the base of the cone, so it's a representative of a torsional cycle. That's basically the only choice you have in this kind of simple configurations. All right. So let's do that in a bit of detail. Let me put the theory on some 11-dimensional manifold, which is some 10-dimensional manifold times time, say. And we want to understand the Hilbert space, or more precisely, the gradient by flux. So as I said, M-theory contains M2 brains, and M2 brains coupled to C3. They are three-dimensional objects, and they are electric charged under a field I can call C3. And the magnetic charge you can measure by the topological class of C3. Now, to measure the electric charge, you have to worry about quantum mechanics here. In the Hamiltonian formulation of the theory, the canonical momentum, which is conjugate to C3, is a star of G4. This is just because the Lagrangian is DC3, star of G4. The star of G4 is precisely the thing that you integrate to measure the electric charge. So, as usual in quantum mechanics, if you choose C3 to be the position, say, then you should think of this as the momentum. And to give a wave function, you should give it in terms of positions or momenta. So if you choose to give it in terms of positions, like C3, then being an eigenstate of momentum means that it picks up a phase when you shift the position. I remember in quantum mechanics, in basic quantum mechanics, the eigenstate of momentum, you write something like this. So this is an eigenstate of momentum in the position representation. And you learn that this thing has momentum p, because if you take x plus alpha, this gives you e to the I p alpha phi of x. Right. So you can read the momentum by seeing the phase in here. So some idea here, you shift the position, which in this case is C3, field, and you pick a phase, and if this phase is proportional to the shift, that gives you a charge. So this is how you measure electric charge in this way. There is a subtlety. You're supposed to do this for all flat lambda. I can explain later if anybody's interested why this is flat. So we cannot measure simultaneously these two things if shifting by lambda changes the topological sector where C3 lives. So that will happen, that you shift the topological sector if there are flat topologically non-trivial lambdas. That's the statement that torsion of H4 is different from zero. Right? So whenever there's torsion, the punchline here is that whenever there's torsion, position and momentum in this case, which is essentially the electric and magnetic charges of your background, don't commute and you cannot measure them simultaneously. Because I want to talk about flux operators, this thing that I'm integrating over a surface, I can restate things in the following way. For every element of torsional H6 in homology, or H4 in cohomology, there's a unitary flux operator, and similarly for any of these, there's a unitary flux operator, and these operators in general do not commute. And the way that they don't commute has to do with the linking pairing between this six cycle and this So the linking pairing between torsional cycles can be defined as follows. Because they are torsional, you know that there's some n such that n sigma is a boundary. And now you can simply compute the intersection between this d, the thing that n sigma is a boundary of, with the other element, sigma prime, and divide by n, and you can convince yourself this is well-defined modulo 1. There's a torsional pairing, which is well-defined modulo 1. And this is precisely the thing that appears in the phase here in the non-commutation relation. OK, so this is to give you a little bit of detail of the calculation. But the thing to keep in mind is that this pairing is perfect, meaning that basically you cannot specify both all fluxes, all electric fluxes, and all magnetic fluxes at the same time. If you fix all the electric fluxes, there's always some problem with the magnetic. In particular, you need to turn on some flux at infinity. You cannot just say electric and magnetic fluxes are equal to zero, which is what people doing extreme model building typically try to do to start with. In this case, you really have to turn on some flux. You have a choice of which fluxes to turn, but you cannot put zero. So the final algebraic structure is simple. We have a Hilbert space and a set of non-commuting operators. And you can specify a state in the Hilbert space as usual. When you have a Hilbert space and non-commuting operators, you choose a maximal set of commuting operators. And you specify your state by giving the eigenvalues under those sets. So here I wrote the choice that means no flux for this maximally commuting set. If you want to turn on some flux, then just turn it on, meaning you put eigenvalues here. Okay. Any questions? This was a little bit subtle, but that was probably the most subtle part of it.
I have two questions. One is there some sort of Lagrangian reformulation of this Hamiltonian picture where I can just literally insert these defects that measure the flux into the Lagrangian, mm-hmm. integrate out, and sort of plug back in to rederive the phase? That you
yeah. found? It's a bit tricky. There's something new with my students, Agar. It's a bit tricky because it has to do with self-duality. This comes from having electric and magnetic fluxes at the same time.
Oh, I see.
So that makes the Lagrangian description a little bit difficult, but you can do something.
Oh, I see. Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, yeah, I had one basic question, which is, why does it have to be maximal? I've seen some places they say that if you don't choose this maximal isotropic sublattice, then it's not modular invariant or things like this. But
my statement is just our representations of the Heisenberg group. You want to fix a state, you have to give me this structure. The physical explanation for why the lattice of states in a compactification has to be modular invariant, to me, that seems to require coupling to gravity, and it's not clear to me why I should apply for free theories.
Mm-hmm.
But this is just a 10-minute representation of the Heisenberg.
So the state's not fully specified unless...
It's not fully specified, actually.
I see. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right, so that was the abstract sort of thing, but we can go back to M theory and our orbifold. So let's try to understand the space of possible theories for a fixed choice of G, or if you like, a fixed choice of orbifold here. Remember that it was a subgroup of S. So we have that, here's what I was trying to find before. C2 mod gamma is a cone over S3 mod gamma. So if you want to understand the boundary conditions at infinity, you want to quantize the flux sector of M theory. In principle, you have to quantize everything, but the sector I just described is the non-trivial bit. You want to quantize the flux sector of M theory in R times S3 mod gamma times M7. So I'm thinking of R here as the time direction, and you should identify it with the radial direction of this cone. So gamma acts freely on S3, and that means that pi 1 of S3 mod gamma is just gamma. And then you can construct H1, the thing that gives you the interesting structure here. And you can compute all the possibilities quickly. So you have these gammas, the subgroup of SU2, here they are, the associated algebra, ADE, and this is the abelianization of this gamma, which happens to be the center of the simply connected form of the Lie group with algebra G. So there's a deep connection with field theory that starts appearing here. Right. A priori, this seems like a miracle that you have an SU2 subgroup here, and it has anything to do with connected Lie groups. Of course, we know this has to be like this because of general reasons. So here are the things that our flux is leaving in H1 and the leaving disalpinization. So just to make life simpler, I think this is an assumption that we would like to drop eventually, but so far we haven't. I will assume that M7 is closed and has no torsion. Then you just use QNF, and you get basically the fluxes leaving spaces like this. So the electric, so this is the magnetic one, the magnetic flux lives in H2 in cohomology, H2 in homology, with coefficients in double initiation of gamma, so the center of the Lie group. So this is starting to look familiar. I'm saying that the one of the fluxes lives in some cohomology group with coefficients in the center of the group. Very familiar from for example, reading between the lines. And similarly, the other flux lives in a different group here with coefficients again in the center of the group. They have a linking pairing, which you can work out, which is basically the intersection pairing in your M7 times a linking form in extreme mode gamma. So you have to understand the linking form in extreme mode gamma, but it's an exercise. And here's the result. And here's the answer that you find physically. The physics answer is that the possible global forms of the D equal to 7 theories in M7, superhamming theories in M7, are given by maximal commuting subspaces of this group here, with commutators determined by this linking pair, the purely geometric linking pair. And now you can go and check this against the answer obtained from field theory in Haruni 7 and Tachikawa. They didn't do a seven-dimensional case, but that's a trivial extension of what they do. And you find that there's perfect agreement. Everything they say can be reinterpreted geometrically in this way. What have we gained with this is that now, at no point in this discussion, we had to refer to the Lagrangian of n equal to 7 theory. It was a purely geometric statement about the space in which we were putting our string theory and fluxes at infinity. So now we can do this for any theory where you have a geometric formulation. And I should mention, because it's going to be useful, I wanted to mention this because it was going to be useful for the two-group story. I think I'm not going to say much about the two-group story. But I know. But let me mention it because it's a beautiful result anyway. One of the basic ideas in Haruni 7 and Tachikawa was that you look at line operators and you have to classify line operators modulo screening by dynamical states in your theory. So you can also do this non-perturbatively because we have a good understanding geometrically of what line operators are and what the dynamical states are. So line operators are non-compact brains. Dynamical states are compact brains. So the things that you should classify are the non-compact brains, which I'm writing as the brains in the relative homology of the total space modulo the boundary. So you should think of this as the non-compact cycle with boundary at the boundary. So non-compact brain. Modulo the compact ones, so the dynamical states. And this is the answer from screening. And short computation using basic properties of homology tells you that this quotient here is exactly the same thing I have been computing, which is the first homology group of the boundary, meaning the place where the fluxes live. So this thing I just told you about, this computation from fluxes, it has to agree, and it does agree, with the computation from screening. And this was computation from screening was done in this paper by Michele. All right, so far I explained where does the relative structure come from string theory, but the picture is a bit different from the countries we have been here in this conference. All right, so we have CFT here, which is D minus 2n dimensional, and it's a transverse space, it has dimension 2n. But we want to construct a SIMTFT in which the transverse dimension is one dimensional. Instead of this picture, so we have some theory here, T of X. And instead of this picture, we want somehow to go to a picture, we have T of X here, and a one higher dimensional symmetry theory. Right. So this is T minus 2n, and this is D minus 2n plus 1. So how do you go from the string theory description, which I just sketched, but you can argue in more detail, it has the right properties for fixing these issues with the theory being relative and so on, to the description which is a bit more standard. Okay. So this is the picture I want to obtain eventually. And what I will obtain is this symmetry theory here and this T with hat. So the thing that lives at the singularity, you should think of as the as T with hat. So T tilde, those are the modes of the singularity. And this symmetry theory I'm going to explain to you now how to obtain from the rest of the string theory construction. You should think of rho as the boundary conditions that I have been imposing. Okay? That's the dictionary, essentially. But you want to go from something that is a cone of fairly high dimensionality to something which is an interval or a segment. So how do you do this? Well, you do sort of the obvious thing, and you integrate over the base of the cone. In this way, you can go from a cone to a semi-infinite segment. Of course, the notion of integrating string theory on the base of this cone is subtle. You have to do with a little bit of care. And we gave the first steps in this paper with Fabio, Federico, Sagar, and Sakura. And we obtain this result. So let's do five-dimensional superconformal theories. Those are a set of interesting examples which are still quite tractable. So you put M theory, which is 11-dimensional, on a Calabi-Yau threefold, a singular Calabi-Yau threefold. That means a six real-dimensional cone with a singularity at the origin. And at the base of the cone, you get a five-dimensional theory, which is very often an interesting one. It's a superconformal theory. And we want to understand the symmetries of the superconformal field theory. So in this paper, we played this game. We integrated over the base. And we obtained couplings like this, the effective action for the symmetry theory. This is a theory in six dimensions. So this is how it looks. And it has a bunch of coefficients that you can compute. They turn out to be classical Spinzer-Simons invariants. For me, the link is the base of the cone. So you want to compute these invariants, and they give you the properties of the field theory. And the tools here are differential cohomology. So Dan has written some very beautiful papers on this that we followed. And in cases where there's both a geometry and a field theory, we could compare. So for example, in the case that we get some SUP at level Q theory, you get coefficients which are of this form, and you see the structure is quite intricate, but we could reproduce it beautifully. So this was obtained from field theory in Gukov, Pei, and Sin, and in our paper we did geometrically. There are many cases in which you don't have a field theory, but you can still do the geometric computation. So I haven't explained the details, and that's Federico, I think, is going to talk about that tomorrow. And Sarah also has a poster, and she talked in the Gong show yesterday. And you can see there how to actually do this computation. And because the time is short, I think I'm going to skip this result and just say one word. Everything I described so far was basically about the one-form symmetries. We are not quite at the level that we have non-invertibles, but the thing that we do know how to do since a few months ago is two groups. And the idea of, we can discuss two groups in a very similar way. The main subtlety that, I don't have pictures, let me do a picture. The main subtlety is that to include two groups in this discussion, instead of going from geometries which have a singular point at the origin, you can obtain theories with two groups if you include geometries that have a singularity at the origin, but this singularity is non-isolated, so it extends to infinity. So this blue line is a line of singularities going to infinity. So analyzing geometry like this. Ah, the blue, okay. Let me try purple. Is that worse? It's probably worse. Well, let me gesticulate. So you have a cone. There's a singularity at the origin, but also a singularity along my arm that goes to infinity. Okay. And by studying these singular geometries, we could work out the structure of the two group in some cases. Again, the philosophy is in the cases where there's a field theory, we agree with field theory. In the cases that there's no field theory, we obtain extensions. So very beautiful, but I'm out of time. So. Let me do conclusions. For geometrically engineered theories, there's a close connection between the symmetries of a theory and the geometry. But one thing that is becoming clear is that with a little bit of work, you can work out the symmetries even in cases that the field theory is entirely mysterious. And this is a disclaimer. I have been very bad at citing. So I have focused on the developments I understand best, which is code for my own papers. But there's a lot of recent literature that's developing complementary approaches. And that's all very interesting. And there's also all the literature on anomaly inflow, which is relevant here. So the new bit here compared to anomaly inflow is that now we are talking about non-invertible theories, anomaly inflows. Intrinsically invertibles. And we typically tend to focus more on the discrete sector. Anyway, there's a lot of work that's very interesting. And there's lots of people in this conference that are working on this topic. So if anything I said is confusing, you might have a better chance with it. We don't have quite the full systematic dictionary yet. There's the hope that we can eventually build one. But I think the general picture is gradually becoming clear. And with that, I finish. Thank you.
Thank you, Iñaki, for the very nice talk. Are there questions from the audience?
Yeah, it's just a curiosity. What do you have on the story of two groups? The two groups are typically classified by the posting of class, no? So do you have some, like, say, geometric understanding of the posting of class?
Thank you. I have for two groups, you mean, no?
Yeah.
I have skipped that because of lack of time, but happy to use that. Can spend a minute on that. Right, so there's this sort of short exact sequence in the context of two groups. And for the examples I discussed, the non-triviality of the Posnikov class is equivalent to non-triviality of the extension class here. And what we did in the paper, fundamentally, was reinterpreting the terms in this short exact sequence as geometric objects. So, we turn this short exact sequence into this short exact sequence of homology groups of the link. Okay. And then all you need to do, there's a little bit of work involved, but now you can think about this homology group, how it embeds in this homology group, and if it becomes non-trivial in the sense of extensions, then you know you have a non-trivial Posnikov class. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Simple.
More questions?
So in the like ALE singularity example that you explained, everything ended up sort of only seeing the homology of the link of the singularity. Is this a general fact or is it special to that example?
When you say singular homology, you're trying to contrast with other homology theories?
Like you could have imagined that maybe the final answer saw more of the topology than just the homology.
Oh yeah. Okay, I can give you two answers. One is that it's quite clear that homology is not going to be the right framework in general. String theory, for example, in TEP 2 prefers K-theory. So this calculation, if done properly, should be done in K-theory. And the paper, we have a little argument showing that the K-theory in this case is the same as the homology, so no difference. But in general, if you complicate the geometry sufficiently, you put torsion in the spacetime manifold enough, then K-theory and homology start to differ. And in those cases, I think K-theory will be the right framework. There's a second part of the question, which is for S3 mod gamma, the homology is a very weak sort of invariant of the space, so you have like a Poincaré sphere. And in that case, you would like to construct something in the TFT that depends on homotopy. And we don't know what that is. I wondered a lot about that, but I don't have an answer. Very good question.
Are there any other questions? Maybe I can ask, this is related to the first question. So I wasn't understanding the intuition as to why with the second geometry you drew is related to the two group structure.
Yeah, so let me briefly explain that, yeah. So a two group is a way of mixing one form symmetries and zero form symmetries. The one form symmetries come, as I was describing, from torsion on the horizon manifold. But you still need a zero form symmetry, an ordinary symmetry. And the way those appear in M theory, those are singularities that go to infinity. So because you have this line of singularities that you cannot see apparently going to infinity. This is a seven-dimensional Jan-Mears theory that has a defect where your CFT lives. From the point of view of the CFT, this is a CFT coupled to a global symmetry given by the seven-dimensional theory. So the reason you want singularities here is to get the flavor symmetry, the zero-form symmetry part.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Yes, one more.
Okay, so your construction works for n equals 4, obviously, no?
Yeah.
But when you fine-tune the complex coupling on n equals 4, you get the non-invertible symmetries, no,
yeah.
As we saw. So do you see any discontinuity in this symmetry TQFT? What do you expect?
Well, the answer is no. The better answer is, I think a lot of people in this room, myself included, were thinking of non-invertibles. So hopefully we can give you a better answer. In a few minutes.
Okay. If there are no more questions right now, we'll go to lunch. Let's thank Inyaki again for a nice talk.